All right. Why? Why is the Sermon on the Mount so rememberable? Now, if you're looking at that and you're thinking, rememberable is not a word, you're not wrong. But if I were to ask you, name some quotations from the Sermon on the Mount for reference, we're talking about Matthew chapter 5 through 7, you could tell me probably 4, 5, 6 things from that series of texts. Even non-Christians, there are so many iconic phrases that even non-Christians know the content of the Sermon on the Mount, even if they probably don't have any idea where it's from. Well, that's from Matthew 7, or that's from Matthew 6, or that's from Matthew 5. They don't know that, but these phrases have permeated American civilization. You are the salt of the earth. Well, okay, you know that guy, he's a real salt of the earth sort of fella. They have no idea that that comes from the Sermon on the Mount. What about judge not? You've heard this, I've heard this, we've all heard this. This is the probably rallying cry of Tumblr. Judge not, lest you be judged. Well, how many people know that that's from Matthew chapter 7? The golden rule. Again, people know the golden rule, and they probably even know that Jesus said it, but they have no idea that it's from this particular sermon. Even people who are not trying to please God, even people who don't have a relationship with God, that is how iconic this sermon is. These three chapters, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, we began with, of course, looking at the Beatitudes the last few weeks, well, last 10 weeks or so. We've looked at the Beatitudes, and this is the conclusion. He begins with this list of blessed are, blessed are, blessed are. And at the end of all that, three chapters of preaching, when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority and not as their scribes. We begin in the Beatitudes, and we see these sort of countercultural ideas. And he says, happy are you when these horrible things are happening to you. Happy are you if you have these attitudes that the world does not have. He is teaching in a different way. These are ideas, most of the things in the Sermon on the Mount. He has, in fact, a section. You have heard that it was said this, but I say to you this. You have heard that it was said this, but I say to you this. He is expounding upon, explaining things that the Jews have been reading for 1,000 years. These things in the old law, these things that they've heard for millennia. And yet he is doing so as the author of those original principles. When he says, you have heard that it was said, but I say to you this, he's explaining things that he himself was involved in writing as God, the author of the Old Testament. So he's teaching and explaining these things as one who has authority. He's not interpreting someone else's text. And really, that's what I do, isn't it? This sermon right now, I'm not explaining to you my words, my ideas, my thoughts. I'm explaining the thoughts and words and ideas of someone else. When Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount is preaching, and really all the other times that he's preaching, he is telling them about his own ideas, the things that he as God have dictated to be so. So when he teaches with authority, he's not teaching as one explaining the words of another, but explaining his own words and ideas. Remember who Jesus is speaking to in the Sermon on the Mount. His audience is Jews who were living in an occupied Israel, occupied by a foreign government. Jews that were living in a time when they were not really in charge of their own destiny. These were people who were bound under the law of Moses. Remember that the law of Moses doesn't go away until sometime between his death and resurrection. So for the next 3 or so years, they're still living under this old law. When he's preaching to them, it has to have a meaning for that. And in this sermon, Jesus is indeed giving people a glimpse of the new way that will come. This is sort of a foreshadowing sort of a deal. He's not only explaining things that matter to them, but he's explaining things that will matter more when he's ascended. This law that will come into effect, the new law, the law of liberty, the way that we have to live. Jesus is giving them sort of a sneak peek, a preview, if you will. This is how things are going to be in the next 3 years. This is going to be the way that it is. But remember that this sermon had to have meaning for the people hearing it in the moment. The people that are sitting around the countryside with Jesus, this has to mean something for them. It doesn't just mean stuff for us. He's not preaching to us. He's preaching to those people sitting around the mountainside. So as we try to understand the Sermon on the Mount, as we do in any of the texts of the Gospels, what did it mean for them living under the law of Moses? What does it mean for us as he's looking forward to the new thing that's going to come? The Sermon on the Mount, and this is why it's so iconic, I think, expounds upon universal truths about God's expectations for his people. What do I mean by universal? These are principles and concepts that transcend any particular covenant. These are principles and concepts that really get into the foundational way that God expects his people to act. He expected the people under the old covenant to act this way. He expects people under the new covenant to live this way. This is the way that God, transcending any particular set of laws, expects his people to behave. And so it has meaning for them, and it also has meaning for us. And remember, he is explaining, not as one who is a teacher of the law, not as the scribes or the Pharisees who have to interpret somebody else's ideas. He is explaining things that he is the originator of. He's the one who made up these things, came up with these ideas. These are his laws. So let's continue our look at this great sermon. We've looked at the Beatitudes. We keep going in Matthew 5, 13 through 16. This was read for us. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. What do salt and light have in common? Jesus, in this text, and most of you, I think, probably all of you, if you look in your Bibles, you have different headings in the Sermon on the Mount. These two things are grouped together most of the time, not always, but most of the time these two ideas are grouped together because I think they're trying to make the same point. Jesus is using two separate analogies, technically three, which we'll get to try to say a common thing. What's in common between these? At a cursory glance, they don't have much in common. One's a seasoning and the other's a complicated mess. I'm not going to get into what light is. I didn't want to put it up on the slide. But there is a commonality between this seasoning and this whatever it is, lights, especially in the way that Jesus uses them. Does salt serve a purpose by itself? How many of you just take the salt, dump it in a spoon, and eat it? Have you ever done that? You'd think it'd be good. It's not good. Don't try it. It's terrible. Salt is not meant to be used by itself. Similarly, why would we need light if there was nothing to see? When is that you don't want light? When you're going to shut your eyes, right? When you're trying to sleep. I don't want light. Who wants light when you're trying to sleep? Light exists, not independent, but light exists to illuminate a different object. If there's no other objects, if you don't have eyes, if you can't see, you don't need the light. Similarly, if you're not eating any food, you don't need the salt. We're not going to get into the preservation qualities of salt because I don't think that's what he's getting into. Both salt and light exist to influence and affect other things. Neither of these things, salt or light, serve any purpose by themselves. They only exist to enhance or affect something else. Salt is supposed to season. A couple of verses here. Matthew 5:13, we'll look at one on Luke. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. Salt is good, but if it's lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is of no use, either for the soil or the manure pile. Not even worth it to throw on the ground, throw it away. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. That's in Luke 14. Salt has a purpose, and that purpose is to season. Light is supposed to illuminate. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all the house. That's in Matthew 5, 15. Luke 8, a similar text. No one, after lighting a lamp, covers it with a jar or puts it under a bed, but puts it on a stand so that those who enter may see the light. For nothing is hidden that will not be made manifest, nor is anything secret that will not be known and come to light. There is zero point to having the light if you're just going to cover it up. It needs to hit the things that you're trying to see and bounce off so you can see the things, right? They didn't know that about light, but that's how we think about it in scientific terms. Light needs to reach the object that it's trying to illuminate. If you cover it up, it serves no purpose. Putting it together, in the case of both salt and light, Jesus, I think, is making a statement about purpose. both salt and the lamp have that specific purpose. And if you void the purpose of salt, what did he say? What good is it? It's good for nothing except to be trampled underfoot. Throw it away. If you void the purpose of the lamp, what good is it? Just leave the lamp unlit if you're just going to cover it up. There's no point to it. Don't even use the lamp. God's people have a purpose. Remember, he's talking to people under the old law. This applies to them as it applies to us. God's people, this universal truth transcending any particular covenant, God's people have a purpose. And the purpose is the same as the salt and the light. The purpose of God's people is to affect other things, other people. Matthew 5:16. In the same way, let your light shine before others. Not just out in a field by itself. You need to be around other people so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Our purpose, in many ways, is to illuminate God's glory. It's not even about seeing the lamp, right? You don't light a lamp so you can see the lamp. You light a lamp so you can see all the other things. Just like God's people, it's not about illuminating myself. It is about bringing light to God, magnifying it, making it bigger and bigger and more understood so that people can see God's glory. That's what we're supposed to do as God's people, to live in such a way that other people can see, because of the light, see what I did there, God and his attributes. That is, maybe not the primary, but one of the primary purposes of his people. Colossians 4, 5, and 6, talking about salt. Walk in wisdom towards outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. This is an interesting text, and our purpose is to interact with others in a beneficial way. He has two things here about useful versus not useful, wise versus unwise. This idea of making the best use of the time and how answering each person the way that you ought. There's a right and a wrong way to interact with people, right? There's a beneficial and a, what's the opposite of beneficial? Detrimental? Sure. There's a beneficial and there's a detrimental way to interact with people. The question that we have to ask ourselves is, are our interactions with others good and useful, like salt that has flavor still, or pointless and condemnable? Like salt that has no flavor, throw it away, get it out of here. How do you interact with those around you? Do you make their lives better or no? Remember, of course, that there is a highest good in regards to dealing with others. If we're talking about trying to interact beneficially with other people, interact in a way that is wise, making the best use of the time, answering each person the way that they ought to, thinking about things on an individual level, what is the highest good? Wouldn't it be that you would influence them for God? We want to make people's lives better. Sure, we do. And isn't that what salt does? It makes food taste better. I want to make people's lives better. But the best that I can make their lives is by teaching them about God. Amen? There is, of course, one analogy we've overlooked in the text. We talked about salt and light, but there is like this throwaway hidden line in the middle of this. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Now, in context, this probably is referring to Jerusalem itself, right? Because Jerusalem was an elevated city, elevated above the surrounding countryside. Then when Jesus says this, a city on a hill cannot be hidden, he's not saying should not be hidden. There's a very interesting word choice here. A city on a hill actually can't be hidden. There's a difference between cannot and should not. And I think that there is an important difference for us today thinking about this text. You think about Jerusalem, that city elevated, there is nothing the Jews could have done to hide Jerusalem. It was there, people could see it, you could see it for quite a ways around. Unless you just want to destroy it utterly, raise it to the ground, get rid of all of the architecture, all of the buildings, that city's not being hidden. It is actually impossible for it to be hidden. God's people, for God's people of any age, that old law, the law of Moses, living under the law of liberty today in the Christian way. For Christians of any age, this analogy should be forceful. A true Christian, note the word choice, a true Christian cannot help but influence others. The word choice is not should. A true Christian cannot help but affect other people. As opposed to what word? Should not. I think the word choice is intentional. It should be impossible to stop you from affecting those around you for good. Just by the way that you live your life, the way that you interact with God and the priority set that you have and the changes that are being wrought in your heart by the Holy Spirit, the knowledge that you're accumulating through God's word, the accumulation of those things should literally make it impossible for you not to interact and influence others for good. Of course, it doesn't work out that way a lot, doesn't it? In the sermon, in the moment of the sermon, who was it that needed to see the light of God's people, to taste the good salt, as it will? In the moment of the sermon, not talking about today, but for those people sitting around on the countryside, who needed to see their light and who needed to taste their salt? Well, one, the occupying Romans, who didn't really care about Jehovah. They had their own gods, I suppose. They didn't really care about Jehovah, but there was a bunch of Romans and Greeks in the Jewish area in Israel that needed to see God's glory, that needed to have their lives enhanced by God's people. What about the Pharisees and the religious elite, people who were living in Jerusalem, who should have understood what God wanted them to understand, but they needed to be affected by God's people? Those of their own nation who had succumbed to the world. People like Zacchaeus. People like, in fact, probably several of the apostles who had drifted away from the teachings of God. These people in that time needed the influence of those who loved God so that they too might love God. And in bringing this forward to the church today, thinking about this from a practical perspective, I want to conclude with three questions. And these are three questions that we each individually need to be asking ourselves. We need to be asking ourselves about this as a family, our family units, your spouse, your kids. And of course, we need to be asking ourselves these as a group. Does our assembly, how do we answer these questions? Number one, who is around me that I can influence? And when it comes right down to it, salt and light, I guess the advent of the internet has changed this a little bit. But people in, I don't know, pick a country, Sweden. My salt and my light is not generally going to reach Sweden. It's just not. But there are tons of people in this community. There are tons of people in my family that I really have an effect on, or at least I should be. People that are practically available to me to influence for good. And we need to be asking ourselves specifically, who is around you that you can influence? Who is around you that you can have an effect on? And it's interesting what he says in Colossians, right? Because we read this, making the best use of the time. My time is not best spent trying to reach people in Sweden. Now, if I went there, that'd be a different case. But living here in Dewey, Bartlesville, Oklahoma, the best use of my time is probably reaching out to my neighbor, or the people I see at the grocery store, or the people that you guys know, or the people that I'm having studies with. Those are the people around me that I can influence. We need to be intentional about trying to reach those specific people. Number two, does my presence add value to the lives of those around me? Just like salt adds value to the meal. Salt makes the meal taste better. I've said this a lot. The analogy is simple. Salt makes things taste better. We had a meal yesterday that we had salt on it, and it was delicious. Does your presence in the lives of others add value to their lives, make their lives better? Because don't we all know people like this, that man, when they're around, it's a drag. Right? You know people like this. I know people like this. That when they're around, they're not really pleasant to be around. They don't really add value. I don't want to be that kind of person. I want to be the kind of person that when others see me, they are eager because I add value to their life. I make their life better, not worse. And it's going to require some honest self-evaluation. And really, what it's going to require is, to answer this question correctly, what are you going to have to do? You're going to ask the people that you're around, right? You're going to, at some point, have to ask people, when I'm around you, does it add value, or am I one of those people that you try to avoid? And don't get offended at the answer, right? We're trying to be better. We need to be honest and have honest self-evaluation. Third question, final question. Do others have a clear view of God because they know me? This is the light, isn't it? You light a lamp so that people can see the objects that are around. We've all done this. You wake up in the middle of the night, you've had the lights off because you wanted to be sleeping, and you try to get to the bathroom, and what do? Well, now I trip over toy cars. That's what happens. Because I didn't see the car because there was no light to see the car. The purpose of a lamp is to make things clearer. And specifically in the life of God's people, the question must be, is their picture of God clearer? Do they have a better understanding of God? Do they have a better understanding of biblical truth? Do they have a better understanding of what God requires because I am in their lives? Or am I a person that obscures and darkens and dims people's view of God? For this to be true, for me to have a illuminating presence on people, what do I need to do? Well, one, I need to have an accurate view of God. I cannot illuminate God to other people if I myself am living in darkness. I need to have an accurate view of God. I need to be living that out in front of other people, right? Because that's what happens. We live it out at home, we live it out in the church, but then when we're around people who don't know God, we just retreat into ourselves. We don't put ourselves out there. Well, that's not illuminating God for the world. Do others have a clear view of God because they know you? And again, what's going to have to happen? At some point, you're probably going to have to talk about God with people. It just is what it is. It's uncomfortable. Get over yourselves. We're going to have to start talking to God about people to know if we're having a positive influence. I want to conclude with this point. If we are not influencing other people, then we are missing the point. He says this about the lamp and about the salt, right? If the salt doesn't have any taste, if you're not making people's lives better, what is the salt good for? What is it good for? Nothing. It is good for nothing. If you are not influencing other people, you fill in the blank. What point does a lamp have if it's not shining light upon the room? If we are not influencing other people around us, we are missing the purpose of being God's people. We just are. We are not being useful in God's kingdom. We have to be influencing other people